From National Public Radio in New York, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Every day, new patents are issued for such diverse items as life forms, computer software, and medical procedures, things that our founding fathers never dreamed people would own when they set up the U.S. patent system under our Constitution. Patents can even cover broad concepts. One company claims to own the rights to buy and sell things over the Internet. Is the U.S. patent system set up to deal effectively with our increasingly knowledge-based economy? And when knowledge becomes private property, are we stifling innovation or protecting the right to profit from ideas? Some answers and your questions coming up right after the news, so stay with us.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton is holding a news conference with Italy's prime minister at the White House following meetings in the wake of the acquittal of a U.S. Marine pilot in the ski gondola incident. Prime Minister Massimo D'Alema says the case has strained relations between the two countries. Captain Richard Ashby today said that he and his crewmates signed a letter of condolence to the families of the 20 victims the day after the ski gondola incident, but the Marine Corps would not deliver the message. Defense Secretary William Cohen is in Bahrain on the start of a 5-day tour of Gulf and Middle Eastern countries. He's seeking support for the almost daily battles between U.S. aircraft and Iraqi air defense batteries in the no-fly zones over the country. From Cairo, Dale Gavlak reports.
After meeting with Bahrain's defense minister, William Cohen said Saddam Hussein was becoming more frantic to kindle lagging support in the Arab world. Cohen argued U.S. and British warplanes had intensified their attacks in Iraq's no-fly zones because Iraq was targeting the patrol planes with gunfire and missiles. Cohen said he would reassure Gulf allies that the U.S. was responding appropriately to the situation in Iraq. Cohen will also be visiting Egypt, Jordan, and Israel. He'll be discussing military ties and the deadlocked Middle East peace process with them. Cohen will be meeting Jordan's new monarch, King Abdullah, for the first time. He's expected to reaffirm U.S. support to Jordan, which shares a long border with Iraq. For NPR News, I'm Dale in Cairo.
Boxer Mike Tyson has been given an extra 60 days in jail for violating the terms of his parole in Indiana when he scuffled with two motorists after a traffic accident in Maryland. Tyson will do the time in Maryland, where he's serving a 1-year sentence for the assault. A retired Cincinnati area police chief, who was honored a week ago as a war hero, is now admitting that he faked his service record. Steve Hirschberg of member station WVXU reports.
62-year-old Donald Nicholson acknowledges he never served in Vietnam, nor was a prisoner of war as he had claimed. He says he fabricated the story to try to get increased veterans benefits. The former police chief of Amelia, Ohio, came clean after being confronted by the Cincinnati Inquirer, which searched military records after several veterans tipped off the newspaper that Nicholson wasn't what he claimed to be. Last month, the Army National Guard's 147th Armor Battalion honored Nicholson for heroic action while serving in Vietnam. Nicholson had sought recognition and produced documents and a Distinguished Service Cross to support the claims. The Army and the National Guard are investigating whether Nicholson forged military documents and records. The Justice Department might also pursue charges. For NPR News, I'm Steve Hirschberg in Cincinnati.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 197 points at 9,665 in active trading. And on the NASDAQ, the composite index is up 25. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks are on a roll today after a favorable employment report. The unemployment rate rose 0.1% last month to 4.4% as the manufacturing sector lost more jobs. Even so, the economy as a whole created 275,000 new jobs. The report shows no reason for concern about inflation, with worker wages remaining in check. Sport utility vehicles soon will have a new safety warning label. For member station WDET in Detroit, Jerome Vaughn has more.
The new label will warn owners that their sport utility vehicles pose a higher risk of rolling over than do standard automobiles. The label will contain a graphic of a vehicle tipped on its side. The current warning, which has been required since 1984, contains only text. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration ordered the new label. The federal agency says SUVs have a greater risk of flipping over because of their higher center of gravity. The vehicles have a rollover fatality rate of 98 deaths per million registered vehicles. All other light vehicles vehicles have less than half that rate. The new labels will be displayed starting in model year 2000 vehicles. Automakers sold 2.8 million sport utility vehicles last year alone. For NPR News, this is Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
The FBI is investigating attempts by computer hackers to break into secure Defense Department computer networks. A Pentagon official says hackers tried dozens of times a day to penetrate the government's classified computer system, but so far they have been unsuccessful. The New York Times, though, reports that the government is increasingly concerned about some new methods being used by hackers to get around security screens. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve health and health care for all Americans, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Over 200 years ago, the framers of the Constitution laid out a system for recognizing people's right to profit from their own inventions. It was called the U.S. Patent Office. To get a patent, you made a model of your new widget. You proved you thought you had to prove you thought of it first, and then you earned the patent. You probably brought that little widget down to the patent office or sent it in to show them. But increasingly, the products of good old American ingenuity weren't widgets or washing machines or even tangible things anymore. They're now pieces of software code or bits of genetic information and even new forms of life. Is the patent system the best way to deal with the products of our increasingly knowledge-based economy? Should anyone own the right to genetic information that other companies might need or people might need to develop treatments for diseases? How about medical procedures or software codes? Should they be private property? When Jonas Salk developed the polio vaccine, journalist Edward R. Murrow asked, "Who will control the new pharmaceutical?" Salk's reply, "There is no patent. Could you patent the sun?" Well, that's what he said back then. What wonders what he would say today if he were asked. Well, that's what we're going to talk about today, the patent system and the idea of patenting, all these new kinds of intellectual properties that are coming out every day. And if you'd like to talk with us about it, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about the program, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find all kinds of links to our topic. Now let me introduce my guest. Todd Dickinson is Acting Assistant Secretary of Commerce and the Acting Commissioner of Patents and Trademarks at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in Washington, and he joins us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Art. Good to be with you again.
Yes. Rebecca Eisenberg is a professor of law at the University of Michigan who specializes in patents on genetic information. She has also recently headed a task force at the National Institutes of Health, charged with investigating problems involved in the exchange of research tools among scientists. And she's on the line from her office at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Thank you for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
You're welcome. Seth Shulman is a science writer whose work has appeared in the Sciences, Nature, and Technology Review. And his new book is called Owning the Future. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. He's also at WBUR in Boston. Thank you for joining us this hour.
Pleasure to be here.
I took that quote from Ed Murrow out of your book, and I want to start with you because you seem to really be taking the case against the ownership of intellectual property, and the subtitle on the cover of your book is the Battle to Control the New Assets, Genes, Software, Databases, Technological Know-How, and it really talks about all kinds of a brave new world of intellectual property ownership.
Well, I think it's true. We've heard a lot about the knowledge-based economy, and there's no question that ideas and concepts and codes and technological know-how are some of the most lucrative things that you can own today. But I think there's not enough discussion about what it means when we allow private interests to control the knowledge that the economy and our society needs to function. And that's what I see happening now when we see doctors claiming to own medical procedures that they used to share openly with colleagues, and software firms winning monopolies on the basic building blocks of computer code that they need to write new programs, and using that ownership to stifle competitors.
Now, why is that different from just patenting a widget, you know, a new kind of refrigerator or a light bulb?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons. I would say that one is just the reality of this knowledge-based economy itself. The fact that these assets are more valuable than ever before relative to everything else. The second point that I've noticed is that we've inevitably moved up the ladder of abstraction. You talked about it in your introduction, Ira. It's getting to the point where, you know, the patent system, as I understand it, was designed to protect someone's ability to build a new kind of mousetrap. But what's happening now as we move up this ladder of abstraction is that it's becoming very difficult to discern between a new mousetrap and the idea of trapping mice. And that often is what I see people getting control over. The third thing that I'd point out that makes things different now is what I think of as the iceberg problem. One historian put it that we stand atop a Gibraltar of technological inheritance, much of it publicly funded. You know, we pay some $60 billion annually towards R&D of taxpayer money. And what's happening is we're often allowing private parties who make an incremental discovery on the basis of this kind of this technological rock to get control of the whole iceberg. They do something that is essentially at the tip of the iceberg, but it gives them a very powerful ownership control.
You mentioned something interesting about the mousetrap and just the idea of the mousetrap. In other words, it used to be you would patent the mousetrap itself, the mechanism of the spring, that kind of thing. And now you're saying that people are getting patents just for the idea of a trap that catches mice.
Well, I think that's right. You can see it in many, many cases. Let me give you an example that caused a lot of problems a few years ago. A biotechnology company in Wisconsin was the first company to insert genes into to cotton, and they applied for and initially won a patent not on the particular genes that they inserted into cotton, not for the process that they used, but they asserted that they had a right to all genetically engineered cotton. And the U.S. Patent Office granted this patent until an outcry came from industry, and it was reexamined. But this is exactly the kind of problem. How much does that incremental discovery? It was certainly an innovative thing that they accomplished. The question is, what does it entitle them to? And this is something that's become increasingly difficult, I think, to establish at the high tech frontier.
Do you think the patent office is able to keep track of all these things that are going on?
Well, I mean, we'll have to. To ask the patent commissioner that, I think it's a hard job. You have something like a quarter of a million patent applications coming in every year. Some of them are massively thick documents that you have to wade through a huge amount of software code to even understand what they're about. I think that the key thing is that as we see these kinds of problems coming up, we have to remember that what's happening today, to a certain extent, runs counter to some 200 years of democratic tradition in this country, traditions that have stressed equal access and opportunity for citizens. And these traditions have helped create some of the institutions that we most prize, things like national parks and public libraries and universities. And this is the part of the picture that I'm hoping to preserve.
Todd Dickinson, Do you agree with the general trend here that your office is patenting lots of broad ideas that cover things instead of the individual objects themselves?
Ira, we've been having this debate for probably 200 years, to be honest with you.
Uh-huh.
As you mentioned, we've had a 200-year experience since the first Patent Act was passed in the very first Congress. As a matter of fact, the very first patent that was issued on a process. It was on a process for making potash, which is a chemical used in gunpowder and fertilizer. Thomas Jefferson was the first patent examiner. It wasn't on a widget or something that was tangible. It was on a process for making a chemical. Just like today's software, patents are on processes for making and using software. This is the We have evolved into having, I think, the strongest patent system in the world. It's pretty reasonably acknowledged. We are also acknowledged as having probably the greatest technological and innovative and entrepreneurial base in the world, in the history of the world. I don't think that those two facts are disassociated. I think that they relate one to the other. The system we have is a system that's intended to encourage disclosure. It's not intended to necessarily reward for the purpose of making a profit or making some money. It's intended to reward in the sense of giving individuals a limited opportunity to protect and defend the invention which they have come up with by excluding others for a limited period of time. These days, that's usually around 17 or 18 years. It's 20 years from the date they file their application. In exchange for that limited right, what we give them, or what we get, what society gets, is that full disclosure. So people can take that technology and build on it. We don't want to encourage a system where people keep these innovations and these inventions secret and where they can't be built on. We want that to be out there to encourage technological development. And the method we use is the patent system.
Dr. Eisenberg, a lot of people have trouble with allowing patents to be granted or intellectual property to be owned by people or companies that affects public health or possibly public health. Do you have any problem with that yourself? And when you think about, which is the kind of things that you handle all the time?
Yeah, no, I myself don't have any problem with intellectual property rights on matters that affect public health as a general matter. I mean, I think you need, the needs of different industries vary greatly for patents from one industry to the next. We have a unitary patent system that applies the same rules across the board to all fields of technology. In fact, some fields of technology are more dependent on patents in order to stimulate private investment and innovation than others. In empirical studies of how patent-sensitive different industries are, the pharmaceutical industry is always near the peak of dependence on patents. That is, people in the pharmaceutical industry will consistently respond that patents are very important to their ability to continue supporting research and development at the high levels that they've been supporting them, which are really, you know, unprecedented in any other industry in our economy. So I think that we have consistently relied on private sector investment in research and development related to human health, and unless we're willing to, you know, tax ourselves at a very high level in order to make up for the loss of those incentives, I think we need to offer effective patent protection for the pursuit of those discoveries. I think, you know, you can have too much of a good thing. That's not to say that the patent system is operating perfectly in this setting, but I certainly have never endorsed any broad principle to keep the patent system out of areas that affect human health. I think that would be a disaster for human health, given our current reliance on the private sector for innovation in this area.
Seth Chelman, you agree?
Well, I agree. I am no opponent of intellectual property rights, and I certainly believe that people who make a discovery should be able to be entitled to some recompense. But I argue that even a nation that champions private property can venerate a national park system that preserves some land for shared use, land that's sanctioned as too important to our collective heritage to be offered for individual sale. We're also a nation that has zoning laws with regard to tangible kinds of property where we say you can buy property in a certain neighborhood, but it doesn't allow you to build a factory or a high-rise there. Unfortunately, there aren't analogous mechanisms on the knowledge frontier, and I think that as we look to the future, this is the kind of thing we need to begin to think more deeply about. We haven't gotten down to it yet, but we're seeing an unprecedented profusion of legal battles over the control of ideas and concepts, and I think we're still at the beginning of this, but we're seeing hospitals battling with researchers over rights to new treatments, universities hauling faculty members into court about who's going to profit from their research, genetic engineering and computer firms waging fights over proprietary rights to techniques and materials. There was even a case not long ago where two Shakespeare scholars went to court over who owns rights to a particular interpretation of Hamlet. I think we have to wake up to what's going on. It affects our lives, and it affects the kind of society that we're going to live in. Many of the cases seem kind of absurd, and they would be funny if the implications weren't so serious for all of mm-hmm. us.
You talk about researchers keeping their medical records secret from each other as one real problem.
Well, we've had a big problem with patents on medical procedures, and in my book, I talk about a number of stories. Let me give you an example. There's a case that was just recently passed another hurdle in court where a researcher at the University of California in San Diego noticed a correlation between a level of a human hormone in a woman's blood and the likelihood that she might give birth to a child with Down syndrome. This is exactly the kind of research that we've seen for hundreds of years. It's similar to the kind of research that Jonas Salk did that you made reference to in the beginning. This researcher successfully won a patent on his observation. The patent is called the patent on a method of observing placental dysfunction. And what he did is he went around to clinics and hospitals around the country and claimed that they'd have to pay royalties for their right to use a medical test that's given to virtually every pregnant woman in America. In some cases, the royalty that he was demanding exceeded what the insurance companies were going to pay for the test. Now, what happened in this case is that virtually no one stepped up to go to bat to fight this patent, because the costs are so tremendously high. It costs now on average something like $1.2 million to bring a patent infringement case to court. And finally what happened is that Kaiser Permanente, the largest nonprofit hospital chain, did go to court to fight this case on principle, even though it would have been cheaper for them just to pay the royalties. And what happened in the recent recent twist in this story is that they made a deal with this researcher that he would exempt them from paying royalties if they'd drop the suit. So the one large entity that could fight this battle has now dropped out, and we have a patent standing on what is really basically looking at the functioning of the human body, something that's existed for all time and is really just a patent on an observation about how mm-hmm. the body works.
Ira, this is an example of perhaps of how to try to reframe or refocus an issue away from what the real interest is here. I've got a copy of this patent in front of me. It's basically
I do too.
It's basically a diagnostic tool. It's a diagnostic tool very similar to ones we issue patents on every single day. I think the proof that this is a valuable tool is in the fact that while Kaiser Permanente did indeed sue to have this patent declared invalid because they, I think, had some prior art that they felt was invalidating, and this was later settled, any number of institutions have taken licenses under these patents. Licensing is a traditional way of how this information gets distributed in a fair and equitable way in a competitive environment like we have here in the free enterprise system in the United States. Licensing and the level of licensing and the level of royalties associated with that licensing may indeed be an issue, but the fact that the basic patent is entitled, I think, is a valid one. Mr. Schulman, as you pointed out, has written a book. I presume he derives royalties from the fact that he wrote that book as a function of his copyright, which is similar to patent. I don't think he should suggest that he should be giving his book away for free.
All right, we're talking about patenting this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. Seth Schulman, you want to comment?
Yeah, well, if I could just respond to that. I mean, I think it's that since we're talking about a specific patent, let's look at this. This is a patent. I'll read you from the claims. This is a patent. It's called Method for Assessing Placental Dysfunction. And the claims are this method that Mr. Dickinson is saying is akin to other kinds of inventions that we've always allowed. The method is that you take bodily fluids from the woman, this is one piece of it, and you compare the level of this hormone with said sample levels of the hormone measured during the same time interval of pregnancy in women gestating normal fetuses. It's hardly an invention it's a long cry from the light bulb, a far cry from the light bulb, and it's little wonder that virtually all the medical associations and many doctors that I've talked to consider it an outrage that this kind of observation is
so the patent is just for taking the measurement and comparing it to another measurement.
I'm not clear on what the basis of the outrage is. I mean, that might be it might involve considerable. I don't know the specifics of this case, but it might be that the inventor has achieved a really new and useful and non-obvious invention there in discovering that you could anticipate whether a woman is carrying a fetus with Down syndrome on the basis of measuring these levels. Are you suggesting that because it's a diagnostic approach that's an outrage, or are you suggesting that it's because this is something that everybody already knew? If it's because it's something that everybody already knew, then the patent system has ways of dealing with that. If it's because it's a diagnostic method, I think that would be a rather broad principle that I'm not sure you would really want to embrace, to say that diagnostic tests can't be the subject of a patent.
What I'm asking is where you draw the line. And in a case like this, it seems to me that the patent derives simply from the kind of basic research, the observation of the functioning of the human body, that has made our science and technology strong in this country over these many years. My concern is to continue to I've been out in the field to do this book, and I get concerned when I attend seminars at universities where the speaker can't reveal the key pieces of their new research because of concerns about intellectual property rights.
Well, that raises another set of issues, which is policy concerning patenting the results of government-sponsored research, which I think is distinct from issues involving the patenting of the results of private sector research.
Let me go back and get a little more fundamental. Where have we come in the 50 years from when Jonas Salk says, when he talks about the new polio vaccine, I guess in the early 50s, and he's asked by Ed Murrow, who will control the new pharmaceutical? And Jonas Salk says, there is no patent. Could you patent the sun? I mean, what has changed in the climate?
Nothing's changed. Nothing changed at all. Jonas Salk could very likely have been able to get a patent.
But Jonas Salk did
what a lot of researchers do, a lot of government researchers in particular do, which is dedicate the fruits of that research to the public. No one stops people from doing that. No one says you have to file for a patent.
Well, Ira, can I respond?
Let me get Dr. Eisenberg in because she's on the phone there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think there's been a quite fundamental change, actually, in attitudes towards patenting the results of government-sponsored research. A generation ago, the presumption was that the results of government-sponsored health-related research would be made freely available in the public domain, and that was the best way to ensure widespread availability of new advances in government-sponsored health-related research. That policy changed in 1980 with the passage of the Bayh-Dole Act, which encourages institutions receiving federal research funds to patent the results of their research discoveries. Today, universities are allowed to own patents in the results of their NIH-sponsored research or other government-sponsored research, and university patenting activity has increased significantly since that time, largely in the area of biomedical research discoveries. So I think there has actually been a fundamental change, not necessarily in the patent laws, but in federal policy concerning who's going to patent what.
Let me remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. Go ahead.
Ira, if I could just step in for a brief second on this, I think Dr. Eisenberg makes a very good point about the 1980 Bayh-Dole Act and the change that it brought about. But I think that there's something else going on, too, and that the problem is that today many powerful interests are trying to treat ideas as commodities, and we're trying to quietly move to a system where ideas and information are sold the way we sell oil, rice, or running shoes. And the problem is that ideas and information are not like tangible commodities. The notion might fly in the boardroom, but not in the classroom. It's antithetical to what makes our classroom strong. And at root, I think it's not complicated. Think about it. When you manufacture a good, there's a finite amount of it. And the free market has proven fantastic at distributing a finite number of goods among a broad public, supply and demand. But ideas are simply different. They're infinite by their nature. If I make 1,000 pairs of running shoes, Each pair costs a certain amount, and there's only enough to satisfy 1,000 buyers. But if I develop a new life-saving medical procedure, it might have cost me something, but I can spread it around as widely as I want, and it doesn't cost a thing. The more people I teach it to, the more people whose lives will be saved.
There's a problem with that analysis, which is that it costs you money to generate ideas, and that's where the patent system comes in trying to provide incentives to invest in the development of new information technologies or new biomedical research discoveries or whatever. The problem, I mean, this is a...
Well, absolutely, and I have no objection to people getting recompense for the research dollars that are invested, but I think that there's an overriding public interest concern in many of these areas where we have to remember that when we go too far down this road, and this is very much what my book is about, is projecting into the future about the road that we're on and worrying about what this kind of move toward allowing broader and more abstract kinds of conceptual things to be owned is going to do to some of the things that we hold most dear in society, some of the institutions like our educational system, like our public libraries. And that's basically the thrust that I have.
Ira, let me say one thing. I actually agree with Mr. Shulman's, one of his previous comments about ideas. You shouldn't be able to patent ideas. But the bottom line is we don't. It's black letter law. We do not patent ideas. We patent inventions. And sort of rhetorically trying to turn people's good inventions into ideas for the sake of this discussion, I don't think advances it very far.
Well, an idea is a term of art in patent law. I think Mr. Shulman would undoubtedly view many of the things that are getting patented today as ideas, but he wouldn't mean the same thing that you mean by ideas.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, Mr. Dickinson might be right in a legal sense, but I think it just takes a sort of a common sense look at what's going on to see that that we're patenting essentially codified ideas right and left. One place where you see it to an extraordinary extent is what's happening in software. Pretty much anything that you write into software can be granted a patent nowadays, including business practices such as managing mutual funds or, for instance, the website Priceline.com won a patent on the idea of holding an auction on the internet. As Ira mentioned at the beginning, a small firm owns a patent on a particular way of doing business on the internet.
So everybody can get a word in. I'm going to break away because we have to take a 2-minute break. We'll come back and talk lots more about it. Everybody get a chance to react. So we'll come right back. Stay with us right after this short break. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other National Public Radio stations. Contributors also include Immunex, sponsors of the EPIC Manual for Prostate Cancer Patients and Their Families. Information available, 800-IMMUNEX. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. And the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Ray Suarez. In an effort to soften the party's hard-edged image, many Republicans are espousing what they call compassionate conservatism, a marriage of core Republican values and humane social policies. We'll look at how compassionate conservatism might affect debate in the 2000 presidential race on the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about patents and who owns the rights to certain types of information, intellectual property, and widgets. My guests are Todd Dickinson, Acting Assistant Secretary of Commerce and Acting Commissioner of Patents and Trademarks, Rebecca Eisenberg, Professor of Law at the University of Michigan, Seth Shulman, science writer and author of the new book called Owning the Future, published by Houghton Mifflin. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. And when we last left our panelists, we were talking about the idea that Seth was saying that people are not just patenting gadgets anymore, they're patenting ideas, which are not supposed to be patented, I guess, if I sum that up correctly. And Todd Dickinson, you wanted to react to that?
Well, we were talking specifically about software.
Software,
that constitutes an idea or not, I guess. But we have had a long, we at the patent office have to work within the legal construct that the courts set up for us, their interpretation of the laws which Congress lays down. And they have, for over 20 years, consistently ruled that computer software is patentable. Most recently, in a court case where they affirmed the lower court, basically affirmed the lower court about 2 months ago. They affirmed the guidelines that we use for examining software in particular, and as Seth pointed out, the lower court, the mid-level appeals court, ruled that business methods themselves were indeed patentable. This country's existed for 200 years with expanding subject matter patentability, and it's gotten along pretty well. Now, one of Mr. Shulman's arguments is that this kind of patenting may stifle new innovation, particularly in the software area. But I'd submit that we've been patenting software and copywriting software for 20 years, and we have probably never had as an explosive a time of software development and software innovation as we've had during that time. It might suggest it encourages
it. I might take exception to the claim that we've been patenting software for 20 years. I mean, I think patenting of software is somewhat more recent than that. There's been a lot of ambiguity in the decisions of the courts as to what is patentable, and the industry has not primarily relied on patent protection for their intellectual property protection until relatively recently. So I think what we're seeing here really is the patent system entering into an area that's a field of technology that has grown up without substantial reliance on the patent system, and we're seeing some problems with that transition. One difficulty, I think, when the Patent and Trademark Office enters into a new field of technology is it takes a while to sort of get their bearings on what's going on in this industry. They don't have the same base of prior art to draw on in deciding what's a patentable invention, and inevitably some claims issue that don't make sense to people who are not more knowledgeable in the field of the invention. In more mature fields, the Patent and Trademark Office has a core of examiners who are quite experienced and know the industry quite well, and they know what they're doing more. So inevitably, you're going to see some mistakes, some patents issuing that shouldn't issue, and some of those patents are going to be held invalid.
The good news, Ira, is that we have a process for dealing, as you said, we have 250,000 patents that issue each year. We have a process for dealing with those cases where art, for example, which was not considered and should have been considered, can be considered. It's called reexamination. Uh-huh. And individuals, if they come up with patents or non-patented prior art which needs to be considered by the office, can submit that art to the office and have those particular patents reexamined. And I would also say we have a very, very skilled core of patent examiners who examine software patents and business methods patents. Many of them are highly trained. Many of them have PhDs in their subject area. And I think they do a great job of examining these applications. When there are errors made or when there is art which has not been considered, we do, however, have a process for dealing with it.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about patents this hour. And let's go to Ed in Seattle. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Maybe your guest can tell me if this is an invention or just an idea. I'm thinking that there's a lot of room for improvement in computer input devices, such as alternatives to the keyboard and the mouse, and other common input devices. Now, as an industrial designer, I can imagine different ways to interact with the computer, different ways to use the human body to interact with the computer. So my question is, I can imagine these different ways from an industrial design point of view, although I don't have the expertise to develop the innards of the hardware and the software needed to make this work. So is the idea of how you use the human body to interact with the computer, is that by itself patentable?
Just the idea of using different parts of the body.
Let's
say you would describe, I have a foot, I have something attached to my foot, I move it, and something changes in the computer.
That's an appropriate example.
Yeah. Is that an idea, Seth, that is patentable?
I'm surprised that you're asking me when we have lawyers and the commissioner of the patent office here.
We'll get their reaction.
As an outsider, I think that would that looks to me to be a very tame thing compared to the kinds of things that we're often seeing pass through the patent office.
Let me go right to the patent office here.
Okay.
Well, fortunately, it would probably be wrong of me to comment on such a question because it might be something that comes before the office. Let me say this. I was a patent practitioner for about 20 years, and one thing I learned is never give an indication of patentability off the top of my head. The first thing you knew, frankly, is go on, either hire a search firm or do the search yourself. You can go onto our website. We have a website at www.uspto.gov, G-O-V, and you can now search our full-text patents database on that website, and that would give you a first good understanding of what the prior art that's out there is and whether anybody's already invented something similar to that. Uh-huh. Then you're probably best off going to a patent professional, either a patent attorney or a patent agent who's licensed to practice before us, and they can help you analyze that prior art, and if it is appropriately patentable, draft your application.
But it's going to cost him money, right? He's going to have to spend some time and money on threshing out an idea. It's not cheap to get a patent. You have to hire lawyers. You have to have drop diagrams, all kinds of things like that.
Well, you don't have to hire a lawyer. You can do it yourself. We don't encourage that. It's a little like operating on yourself for a medical
concern. Well, it's not that bad, is it?
It is that bad.
But there are a wide variety of attorneys and agents out there who charge a wide variety of fees, so you ought to be able to find somebody to help you out.
So if I can define what this device looks like and how you use the body with it, then that might be enough of an idea that can be protected.
But that's the whole idea, and I hope my guests will comment this. If you don't do it the right way and make sure you get it done correctly, you're going to get ripped off.
Uh-huh.
Your idea is going to get ripped off by someone who knows what they're doing.
Thus the need for professionals.
That's what I say.
Okay.
They may not tell you that, but I've seen enough of the times of it happening that if you don't protect yourself, you say, I can go in and do this patent and don't do it right, and somebody else sees your patent idea, or you discuss it with people, and the wrong kind of people say, oh, I'm going to steal that idea.
Well, I was kind of inspired by David Pressman's book, Patent It Yourself. So maybe I was emboldened too much by that, but I'll also seek some professional help.
That's an interesting book. I tell you one thing that I know Mr. Pressman recommends in that book is that once you've done the initial drafting by yourself, and he does walk you through that process for an application, he does suggest, as I recall, that you might strongly consider taking that draft application to a patent professional to review. Okay. That's actually one way of reducing the cost.
Okay.
I'm a firm believer that you get what you pay for.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ed.
Good day.
1-800-989-8255. In your book, Seth, you do talk about something that was almost what Ed was talking about, ideas. You talk about Jerome Lemelson. You really come down hard on him in your book. As you mentioned, he's got probably second to Edison more American patents than anybody in the 20th century or 19th century or ever. And you talk about him charging rent on dreams, that he was able to patent just ideas that, like Ed was talking about, without actually ever having to really define some of those ideas.
Well, Ira, I was, unfortunately, Jerome Lemelson has passed away a little over a year ago, but I was fortunate enough to get the chance to meet him several times and interview him for the book. And what I sought to do in my discussion of his work, a very interesting guy, was to compare what's changed in today's environment, compare him, say, to our archetypal inventor, Thomas Edison, who was the number one most prolific patent holder. Mm-hmm. And I found that the changes were remarkable. And the key thing is, yes, the charging rent on dreams is a criticism leveled at the U.S. patent system by the British magazine The Economist that I just quoted. But I think that Lemelson points out the kind of shift that we're seeing. When you look at the inventions of Thomas Edison, it's remarkable what a doer he was. He used trial and error. It took him thousands of different materials to find the filament for the light bulb, and he... Uh, He was big on actually building the inventions that he made, that he patented, the phonograph, the light bulb. Jerome Lemelson rarely built anything that he patented. And for instance, he owned things like the recognition tones that our fax machines use to speak to each other.
I mean, those little beeps on the phone?
The little beeps. That was an invention of his. It earned him millions of dollars because every fax manufacturer had to pay royalties to him to be able to build a fax. And this is exactly the kind of question that troubles me. I think in many cases, things like this that are essentially a standard that develops in the industry, we'd be better served if they were held in some sort of public domain and a public trust, rather than letting them enrich a given individual. It's something that everyone needs to play, a process that everyone's going to have to use to make the system work. It seems like we've come a far way from the kind of patent system that Thomas Edison thrived in. Let me just tell you another Lemelson patent. He patented in the 1970s the idea of the camcorder. And basically all he did is sketch out the possibility that you might combine a video camera with a tape recorder and make it a handheld device. He never built this thing. And of course it didn't come onto the market for another 10 years after that. And the question that I ask about Lemelson is, certainly it was a clever idea. He may well have been the first person to think of that. I don't know. I doubt it, but it's possible. The question I have is, what kind of reward do we give for that kind of embryonic concept? And right now, this idea of charging rent on dreams is that we've gotten very far away from the idea, from the doing.
Okay.
And I think it's the doing that should often be rewarded.
We're talking about patents this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Ben in San Diego. Hi, Ben.
How you doing? I'm a mechanical designer here in San Diego, and I've been dealing with patents for many, many, many years, although I don't have any granted. I just wanted to comment first that it's very easy to get a patent granted and extremely hard to enforce that patent, whether it's poorly a written patent or if it's just that you've only patented a small part of that idea. It's easy to get that patent, but very hard to enforce it once you have it. The question I have is basically to the patent commissioner. I've noticed lately, and I think it's been an ongoing thing, that the American Bar Association has been pretty much trying to do away with patent agents and make it so that basically only patent lawyers can deal with the patents people. Do you have any knowledge on how that's going to progress if, in fact, patent agents were not able to practice in front of the patent board, then it would make it expensive for me to get a patent done having not much money?
Well, let me say a couple of things. First of all, you've made the point that it's easy to get a patent. I might take some exception with that, and I know actually a lot of inventors who would probably take a lot of exception with it. We grant about 160,000 patents a year, and we have about 250,000 applications filed a year. So that's roughly the ratio we're talking about. But let me speak to the patent agent question. I'm not aware of any current proposal which would do away with patent agents. Patent agents as a group, have been around for a very long time and are technologically trained individuals who take our bar exam. We have a separate exam at the USPTO, mm-hmm. and they pass that exam having qualified for it first by their technical background. And they exist today, and they're very useful today. Many of them are less expensive than patent attorneys, and I'm not aware of any proposal at the moment which would do away with them.
Yeah, the only reason why I brought that up is because my father happens to be a patent lawyer, and I was interested in becoming a patent agent myself, and he sent me an awful lot of stuff from the Bar Association basically trying to push through some laws that basically said that only patent lawyers would be able to argue in front of the patent board.
I want to underscore your first point that you made, that enforcing a patent can be very costly. Mr. Shulman earlier talked about the costliness of patent infringement litigation as if that were a factor that was weighing against the defendants, that was leading the defendants to settle. But, of course, it's the patent owner who has the burden of going forward and establishing that infringement is occurring, and it can be difficult to detect infringement and difficult to prove infringement. So it's not clear that the costliness of patent infringement litigation is a factor that favors patent owners as opposed to people who are using patented technologies.
We're talking about patents this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. All right, William in Madison, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Getting the cost of filing, obtaining a patent back down to the level they cost 20 years ago is very important in order to allow the average income people to obtain patents. Then, it's not free exchange of ideas, it's fear of exchange of ideas to further knowledge. Now, the patenting of computer language programs, or our genes, slows down the rate of furtherance of knowledge. These are two prime examples of how patents in certain fundamental areas are a negative, not a positive. By having, for example, free access to the Linus computer language program, companies such as IBM, Corel, Red Hat, and people are advancing computer technology in use by leaps and bounds, just by that freedom. In other words, it's free to the people, not patented, Linux is.
And what about DNA you were talking about?
And, I'm an older fella. Believe it or not, when I was a younger fella, I was the first person, it was my doctoral thesis, the molecular genetic mechanism for production of variability in the light and heavy chains of immune globulins. Mm-hmm. That was my doctoral thesis. Did I have a right to patent that idea? No, thank gosh not. Then I went off to research the origins of tribes and languages for about 30 years, and I'm glad I don't have the right to patent if I find out that, for example, some Farah Hotep, Hattupa, was an Estonian or a Finn 2,300 years before the time of Christ. There are certain ideas that are very fundamental, and we should have freedom to put those ideas on top of the table for discussion and for free use by other researchers.
Now let me get a reaction from Rebecca Eisenberg. What about the idea of patenting DNA and things like that? Any problem with the idea that someone could own some part of the code, the DNA code here?
Well, it's a complex question. I think the caller correctly points out that patented inventions are can retard the utilization of new knowledge in some circumstances. That a patent motivates discovery of the patentable invention, perhaps, but then it retards dissemination of that discovery by rationing access to the discovery, by requiring that you get a license before you can make use of the discovery. And certain types of discovery are primarily of value as inputs into further research and development. Under those circumstances, you have to ask whether the inhibition of research that arises from the patent is greater than the initial impetus to research as a result of the promise of the patent, that we may be motivating the discovery of DNA sequences by allowing them to be patented while inhibiting their use in further research to yield tangible products for the improvement of human health.
I noticed an intriguing story in yesterday's Wall Street Journal about a group of pharmaceutical companies that's trying to establish a nonprofit bank of markers on DNA.
Right, that's a good example of this. From the pharmaceutical firm's perspective, these DNA markers are tools to use in discovering new products and in figuring out who can benefit from their products and who is likely to suffer serious side effects from their products.
But they're doing it because they think that the other pharmaceutical companies will patent the markers themselves as they discover it.
They're worried about the biotechnology firms patenting the markers and restricting access to them or charging too much money for access to them. They'd rather pay for the research themselves and be insured of free access rather than have somebody else do the research and get a patent and charge them for access. And that's probably a pretty good indication that the value of patents on that sort of discovery is greater than it needs to be to call forth the investment in developing that knowledge.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the development you mentioned, Ira, is also a really great example. And I'd put it in a bigger frame. You know, we're spending billions of dollars to map the human genome, taxpayer money, much of it. And this is work that's going to guide medical knowledge for the next century. I think it's essential for everyone to think about the overriding public interest, the importance of keeping access free and open to the public over this kind of knowledge. And I think this is a tiny little step being taken by the companies. It would be nice to engage the broader public and other parties to participate more fully in this, too.
I think one of the really interesting aspects...
Let me get Todd Dickinson in.
Well, Ira, let me just comment a couple of things. First of all, we do patent gene sequences now, and there are plenty of companies that apply for patents on those gene sequences. But I'm also aware that the Human Genome Project and other government-funded research is dedicating their work to the public, and that's fine. That's their decision, either party's decision. That publicly dedicated work can stand as prior art against those later filed applications. We will patent it if you bring it to the office, and we will use the congressionally mandated statutes to decide whether it's patentable or not. If you want to change the rules, the place to go is Congress.
That's a good way to end this hour. We'll come back to this issue. It's a very big issue, and something we'll take up lots more on Science Friday. I want to thank my guest, Todd Dickinson, Acting Assistant Secretary of Commerce and Acting Commissioner of Patents and Trademarks, Rebecca Eisenberg, Professor of Law at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Seth Shulman, author of a new book, Owning the Future, published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you all for joining me this hour.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Thanks.
A note to join Ray Suarez on Monday in this hour for a look at community efforts to prevent hate crimes. That's on the next Talk of the Nation. Talk of the Nation Science Friday is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer. Aline Augenbraun, our executive web producer. Our interns are Steve Karish, Ashish Ranpura, Jessa Netting, and Tom Clark. With help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn, and from engineer Paul Gallo in Boston. If you have comments or questions, write to us. Yeah, send them all to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, WNYC Radio, 1 Center Street, New York, New York, 10007, or surf over to our website where you'll find all the links. Anything that you missed, Charles will have it up there. He probably got it up there already. He's so good at this stuff. And it's sciencefriday.com, and you can also leave email messages for us. I'm going to be away for a couple of weeks, so I'll see you when I get back. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
Science Friday is produced by National Public Radio and Samana Productions in association with member station WNYC New York. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. For tapes and transcripts, call toll-free 1-877-NPR-TEXT. That's 1-877-NPR-8398.
Support for National Public Radio comes from National Public Radio stations. And Serta, maker of the Serta Perfect Sleeper mattress, helping generations of Americans to sleep since 1931. The W. Alton Jones Foundation, supporting public understanding of the importance of healthy ecosystems for people's lives. www.wajones.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And the Camille and Henry Dreyfus Foundation, dedicated to the advancement of the chemical sciences. This is NPR, National Public Radio.